Welcome back to Across the Movie Hour, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up, in controversies and non-controversies, no one is going to see the awards-caliber films. At least that's what Brooks Barnes has to say in the New York Times. That's his takeaway from the box office results thus far through the awards season. Tar and She Said have both taken in around $5.5 million, despite costing $35 and $55 million, respectively, to make and market. The Fabelmans cost $40 million plus marketing and has made less than $8 million. Armageddon Time cost $30 million and has grossed less than $2 million. Devotion cost $100 million and earned just $14 million. Why the doldrums? Well, it could be the cannibalization inherent to releasing so many movies aimed at the same sorts of audiences over such a short period of time. Maybe it's competition from TV. Why go to the movies when you have The Crown and White Lotus and Wednesday to catch up on? Perhaps it's lingering coronavirus fears, given that older audiences are more susceptible to the disease, and we're seeing a new surge in cases, and these are movies that are aimed at older audiences, as Brooks Barnes kind of tongue-in-cheek notes. Older includes everybody over the age of 35, so the geriatrics on this show, in addition to everybody else, that's who goes to see these movies. Or maybe it's that sophisticated audiences have nowhere to go, as too many art house and indie-minded theaters closed during the pandemic. Maybe the people are just tired overall of the sorts of award season movies we're getting. Movies about, you know, look, it's racism and inequality and homophobia and oppression. That's we're tired of it. We want to laugh, as one of the sources in Brooks's piece says. Personally, I think it has to do with two factors. Factor the first, Hollywood has trained moviegoers to watch prestige pictures at home, with flicks like Coda and Power of the Dog last year racking up tons of nominations and awards. When you train people to watch awards season stuff at home, that's where they're going to watch it. Factor the second, and I think this may be more crucial and possibly more simple and simultaneously much more complicated, audiences have no idea where to watch these movies. Think about how they used to, or how they still roll these movies out, right? There's a round of publicity on the festival circuit where these pictures debut, but where virtually no one can see them. Then they get a limited release in New York City and LA and maybe Chicago for a couple of weeks, 2 months later, before they expand to more cities, a month after that. By the time they're in 600 or so screens, the initial wave of PR is months behind us, meaning the folks have no idea what to see, where to see it, when it's coming out, where it's out, what's going on. Where do people see ads anymore? Think about the most basic questions, right? What, are they going to look at banners on websites? We all ignore those if we're not actively blocking them. Promoted tweets? I almost never see any of those. Facebook ads? I guess. I don't know. No one reads daily newspapers. We killed radio for podcasts and streaming services. When audiences go to fewer movies, as they have been going to fewer movies, they see fewer trailers for movies, so they have less idea of what's coming up. The decline in the award season movie is, I think, at least in part, a story about the decline in advertising and the decline in local criticism. Once upon a time, every city had multiple critics writing at multiple newspapers telling them what was out there and what to watch. Nowadays, everyone is a national critic. Critics time their reviews to drop all at once rather than when something comes out in their city, because that's the best way to shape the critical narrative, number one, and also earn precious clicks. We got to get those clicks, right? And that leads to reviews being frankly less useful for platforming releases and less useful to the viewers who live in cities outside of New York City and Los Angeles. It's less useful for the readers. That's the crime here. It's less useful for the readers. Which is why I'm a man of the people, as you guys know. I always try to time my reviews for release on the Friday a movie opens, or Friday it opens wider, rather than 10 to 20 days beforehand or 2 months beforehand. It's me saying to the reader, hey, here's what's out this week. You should go see it. But I digress. Peter, why do you think that people aren't showing up for the fancy movies during the fancy movie season?
I agree with everything that you said, actually, because it, for once, Sonny is totally and completely right. But I would add a couple of other factors. The first one is home viewing has just gotten a lot better. And so maybe not a lot better since 2019, but I think a little bit better since 2019. And just in part because people spent a lot of money on televisions and on sound systems, on soundbars and sort of upgrades to their theatrical experience during the pandemic, because people were stuck at home, had no way to spend money outside the home. And so there was a huge amount of home upgrading that happened during that time. So relatively speaking, even in the past 3 years, the home experience has just gotten a lot better. But let's bring it back to like 1997, when, you know, you and I were in high school, Sonny, there were people who had big screen televisions, and there were even surround sound systems that people had in their homes. You know, I had friends who had Bose surround sound systems with, you know, those little subwoofers that like juiced the bass in kind of dumb ways, but everybody thought they were awesome back then because for the technology of the time they were. But for the most part, if you went into even a relatively successful upper middle class home, in most of America, you were going to find like a 32-inch boxy television that was showing stuff in, I think, like 240i or something like that, right? A sort of pan and scan, 4:3, like just the picture quality, the size, the scale of it. If you were watching movies, you were watching them on VHS or just whenever they were broadcast on maybe HBO or CBS or something like that with commercials, right? So you, at best, you were going to get VHS quality. Yes, yes, some people had Laserdisc players. Some people, but almost no one had Laserdisc players. And even then, some of that stuff was shown in pan and scan. Now, almost everyone has the ability to watch a movie in pretty good quality, even if they haven't turned off the motion smoothing. Like, it's just so much better to watch a movie on a 42-inch television today, or a 65, right? Even if it's not the best OLED, right? Like, the difference in quality in homes and the penetration of into homes of gigantic, pretty good televisions is not quite universal. But it, I mean, even people who are not, you know, super rich have big televisions these days, and that just makes a huge difference. You can now watch a movie whenever you want, and also at relatively high quality, or at least comparatively high quality, in a way that was not true 20 years ago, and that's obviously going to change the market. Meanwhile, movie theaters have not gotten that much better. And so I think that it's just sort of that inherently raises the cost of going out, in addition to the fact that the cost of going out has gone up, right? But it raises the cost just in the sense that if the baseline experience of watching at home is much better, then the difference between the two, the difference between watching at home and watching it on a, you know, on, at a theater is, you're going to, I mean, it's just not going to be as big a difference. So I think that's a genuinely a big deal. And I'm not talking about custom home theater installs. And I'm not talking about people who've spent thousands of dollars on their sound systems. I'm talking about, it's just very normal to walk into a middle class home now and find a giant television and a sound bar. Compare that to 2005 or 1995 or 1985. Huge difference. Plus, all of it's on demand. Right? It's all just there when you want it. You don't have to drive to a video store. You don't have to have a big VHS library. And that just makes a huge difference. And you combine that with studios training people to watch things at home because, you know, they're releasing them that way, but also a full year where in most parts of the country, or at least many parts, theaters were either closed or might as well have been closed. And that in and of itself sort of creates an anti-momentum. If you went a year without going to the movies, you, in some sense, have to have become comfortable not going to the movies. And it's only weirdos like us who can't not, who kind of, who got crazy because we didn't go to the movies for a year. And that, and like all of those things just combine for a world in which it's just a lot harder to bring people out to a theater.
Alyssa, I want to emphasize one point that Peter and I both made here, which is you know, I take Peter's point about image quality and all that, but I frankly am like, I don't put that much stock in it, because here's what I've learned about people is that they will gladly take a reduction in quality of a thing for easier access and convenience to that thing. This is what we see with streaming video. It's what we see with streaming audio. It, like, people don't want to put in an LP and listen to an LP. They want access to every song ever made, and they want it on Spotify coming straight to their phone. So my argument here would be less that it's about the quality than the convenience, right? I mean, you're a mom with kids. If you have a choice between going to see something in theaters and staying home and watching it, which are you going
to
do?
Well, and I think it's useful for me to think, I mean, because look, I love going to the movies. I have a job where I can just like go to the movies in the middle of the day. My movie, like, unlike most Americans, my movie going options got radically better during the pandemic because I moved much closer to DC's like last independent, like nonprofit movie theater, which shows first run stuff and is a walking distance from my house. And we got not one, but two Alamo Draft Houses within like a 20-minute drive of my house. So I think it's more useful to think in terms of the threshold for like, when do my husband and I go to see a movie, right? And it's generally when it's something that we're pretty sure we're both going to enjoy. Not necessarily that we're going to be blown away by, but like we're pretty sure is going to be a good time. Something that feels like it should be watched on a big screen. And, you know, those become the tests of when are we going to, you know, when are we going to have the nanny stay late? When are we going to pay a babysitter? It's kind of gotten whittled down to superhero movies. And I'm sort of embarrassed to admit that because, like, we both like good movies. We often, you know, we'll trade off, you know, I'll go see a screening like I'm going to go do with Avatar tonight. And then I'll take the kids another night so he can go with her. But, you know, even as a critic, even as someone who, you know, sees generally at least one movie in a theater a week, you know, the date night movie has gotten really whittled down to the kind of the sure thing for us. And even, you know, that sure thing, I'm sort of putting in air quotes since I'm super burned out on a lot of these movies, but it's sort of the thing that we can kind of justify the overall experience.
Well, but also the thing that everyone's going to be talking about, right? The thing that you know that all your friends are going to be talking about, that people online are going to be talking about, even a movie that kind of underperforms like Black Panther: Wakanda Forever, which, you know, has done $400 million instead of $600 million. Like, that's a movie that's going to be the second highest, third highest grossing movie of the year.
And I think, you know, the point that you kind of glossed over and that shows up in the story is, you know, the question of whether the theatrical experience is worth it. And we've talked about this on the show sometimes. Like, a lot of the big chain theaters are, frankly, that not that nice to visit, right? I mean, the theater at Gallery Place downtown, I find basically unvisitable because the chances are when I go there that something will be radically off with the sound or projection. You know, the only thing to eat is just garbage, like really
garbage that you have to wait in line for 20 minutes.
And frankly, it's often not that clean. And like, you know, I'm almost 40. Like, I'd like the bathrooms to be usable at a theater if I'm going to pay, you know, $15 for a ticket. And one of the reasons that the Alamo and my, you know, local independent movie theater have become must-goes for me is because they're both immaculate all of the time, right? Like, you know, the Alamos are spotless. The food is pretty good. And going there is like an actually pleasant experience in both places. You know, the local independent theater, you know, they don't have as much money to plow into investments. They're not, you know, getting whatever percentage of Disney movies they, you know, the chains get, et cetera. So they don't have as much to invest in production and sound, but it's pleasant. I can generally count on the audiences to behave well, particularly at the Alamo, where like they basically take you out and shoot you if you don't. But when you're asking people to do something,
they're nicer than that. That's an exaggeration.
Yes. Yes. I would support Frontier Justice at the Alamo. It's the only death penalty offense is disrupting a movie. You know, when something already requires sort of big opportunity cost, and then just the physical plant and the experience are going to be miserable on some level, that makes it harder to go, you know? And I mean, when you're like 13, like, okay, who cares if the floors are sticky? Like, you're probably the jackass spilling your popcorn anyway. But at a certain point when you're paying the sitter and it's like your rare night out and the physical plant is unpleasant or hard to navigate, you know, that's I do think that. And it's really hard, right? Like, I sympathize with the theater chains, which are, you know, unless you get to benefit from a meme stock frenzy and pay down a bunch of your debt, it's hard to figure out how to make the investments in infrastructure, you know, figure out paying like good projectionists, everything else. So I am sympathetic to the legacy theater chains and to sort of the struggling independents. But, you know, there's a reason that IMAX has sort of been the thing that's done well while everything else is in trouble is because they create a sense that it's a premium experience. And, you know, and look, there aren't a lot of kind of low cost, casual entertainment options left in, you know, in the American market. But theaters in particular, I think, have not accustomed themselves to the fact that they're a premium product and they kind of have to act like it.
Since you bring up low-cost entertainment options, that brings us to the other thing that we haven't mentioned, which is competition from television content, which is just, I mean, compared to 15 years ago, there's so much more, and a lot of it is much better, right? Yes, we had HBO, and you could watch Deadwood in 2004, and The Wire and The Sopranos, and stuff like that, but in general, there was not a huge amount of original scripted content that was high quality. And now if you are, again, You know, I'm not trying to write out Hill Street Blues and NYPD Blue, and I was like a Babylon 5 fan in the 1990s. I'm not saying there was none.
Yeah, no.
I'm just saying that the sheer number of shows we simply know has gone up, but I would say the number of shows that are of relatively high quality, that are ambitious, and that are aimed at adults has also gone up, and certainly the number of hours of stuff. And so if you are an adult moviegoer who wants to see like a kind of a serious, somewhat ambitious drama, there's just a lot of that on television, and a lot of it is at least pretty good. There are shows that are out there that that aren't even getting talked about that have stars. I mean, I was watching Netflix's Inside Man with Stanley Tucci over the weekend, which I bet you guys haven't even heard of. It's a Stanley Tucci show, and it's actually pretty good. It's a co-production with the BBC, and it's on Netflix, and it's like smart and kind of, you know, clever. And people aren't even talking, but it's because there's a huge amount of stuff out there. And so, like, again, movies have to sort of have to demonstrate a specialness in a way that they did not in 1985 or even 2005, just because there's so much other stuff that, you know, it's at worst, it's like, that was kind of worth an hour on my couch.
I think specifically there is blockbuster television,
yes,
right? In the sense that you can watch blockbuster action television spectacles in, like, you can get 10 hours of that on House of the Dragon, or, you know, 12 hours of that with Andor. And
I mean, frankly, She-Hulk is, you know, more blockbuster-like, more cinematic than almost anything that was on television in 1998.
Yeah. But beyond that, like, again, I would argue beyond the actual quality of the television, and even almost beyond the quantity, though I think this is more tied to it, the delivery device is so much different and so much more oriented toward anytime you are at home, anytime you are trying to figure out what to do on a given night, there is a 10-hour season of television that you can either start or finish or continue. And we have so much of it now that is almost infinite. I mean, like, I haven't started watching Yellow Jackets. I want to watch that show, Yellow Jackets. You know, if I wanted to, I could spend a week of evenings watching that with my wife. You know, I need to finish The Crown, right? I've got several days worth of The Crown left to watch. Mythic Quest has a new season out. If you haven't watched Mythic Quest, there's hours and hours of, you could go through each and every service and find 50 hours of television to watch tonight in a row. And that's
that you
just
probably already paid for.
That you are currently paying for. That you pay for every month and you aren't using.
That you forgot to stop paying for.
I mean, it really is a problem. And I just don't. I love movies and I love movie theaters. And I think that there is a huge structural problem that movie theaters are going to have a very, very hard time competing with, especially when it comes to award season stuff, which, let's be honest, a lot of the time, and I think this is an understated point from Barnes's piece, it gets one kind of a one-off quote, but these movies oftentimes feel like homework. They feel like you got to eat your vegetables and see the important things that have good messages. And I'm sympathetic to the idea that, like, I'll wait at home to do that. I'll wait at home.
Clearly, the answer is Margot Robbie doing a lot of cocaine.
Well, we'll see. When Babylon hits theaters, I think that's going to be the, you know, breakthrough moment for awards season.
I want to make a really quick argument to Sonny about that maybe this is okay, or at least fine in some ways, which is, Sonny, you are a big booster of Sparrow Pizza.
Sparrow.
And there is a Sparrow? Sparrow?
S-B-A-R-R-O. Sparrow. It's Sparrow.
Me. Anyway,
you're
it's
wrong.
Terrible, and it's, but it's there. And
it's
that's the important thing, is that it's there. It's everywhere you are. Sparrow Pizza is there. And that's kind of the streaming experience. It's not the highest quality pizza. But you know what? It's the most convenient pizza. And sometimes the most convenient pizza is the best pizza for you and for, frankly, for a lot of people. Especially if you're not like a hardcore elite pizza aficionado.
No, but I mean, that's not really
be a man of the people, Sonny.
That's not really the right metaphor here. A better metaphor is something like, well, I could go to this, I could drive to the Sparrow and I could eat the Sparrow at the mall, or I could heat up my Mama Celeste in the freezer. And like that, then more people are going to stay home and just eat the Mama Celeste, because even though it's an inferior pizza to Sparrow. All right, this is getting off the rails. All right, so what
do
you think?
Don't talk crap about Red Baron.
What do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that award season movies are in such bad shape at the box office, Peter?
I think it is kind of a controversy, and it's been increasing as a controversy for well over a decade, even before the pandemic.
Alyssa.
Controversy.
It's a controversy, and one that I have no idea how to solve, because structurally things are very bad and probably going to get worse. All right, make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus for our bonus episode this week on Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio, which is on Netflix now and is really a wonderful and beautiful stop-motion animated feature. We're going to be talking about that. You can watch it for yourself now. It's award season. It's on streaming. That's where all the award season movies are. Speaking of which, on to our main event, Emancipation, which is Apple TV Plus's big award season movie starring Will Smith, directed by Antoine Fuqua. Emancipation is about the life of a slave named Peter, who, following the Emancipation Proclamation, escapes from slavery and is chased by a maniacal slave catcher played by Ben Foster until Peter joins up with Union forces who take a photo of his scarred back that would become a rallying cry against slavery and one of the first viral images, and then he goes and rescues his family from servitude. Yay! On a pure storytelling level, Emancipation is fine as like a gussied up exploitation flick. And this is honestly the milieu in which Fuqua, who I like a lot as a director, works best, right? Movies like The Equalizer, Tears of the Sun, Training Day, Olympus Has Fallen. These are all A+, or like at worst A-, genre flicks that combine stardom and archetypes into something that is both rousing and pleasing and maybe just a little bit disreputable. Fuqua has a great eye for action. He has an intuitive understanding of pacing, and they all just kind of zip along really nicely. And on that level, Emancipation is perfectly fine, right? We see the horrors of slavery. We witness Peter's escape. We hold our collective breath as he flees through the swamplands, and he has to wrestle alligators, right? Will Smith is doing an accent. He's trying to free his family. Ben Foster and his cold, dead eyes, right? He was basically born to play a psychotic slave catcher. But Emancipation's big problem is that it is not positioned as a kind of pulpy action film. It's a big award season movie with big social, it's an action movie with social resonance, right? If you can imagine me just saying that in title case, because it's so, you know, serious and important. These two things aren't necessarily mutually exclusive, these two ideas, but they are hard to meld, and this movie is more pulp than prestige, and I don't think it quite understands that. Set aside the plot's mechanics, set aside the acting, set aside the writing, set aside the directing. The biggest problem in this movie is that it is just hard to watch. I don't mean that because of the subject matter, though the subject matter is obviously pretty rough, you know, slavery and war and all that. I mean, it's literally hard to watch. The movie has been color graded to within an inch of its cinematic life. It's just a hair away from black and white, right? It's practically in grayscale, this movie. And this in turn leads to like really awkward creative decisions, like there's CGI fire that they color with CGI red that just clashes horribly with the rest of the look. It looks terrible. It draws attention to how ridiculous everything looks. And I just found myself getting like more and more agitated by the daguerreotype coloring of this whole cinematic endeavor. If you want to shoot it in black and white, then fine, shoot it in black and white. Don't release a film that looks as though the negative has been soaked in mud for a month before prints were struck. I don't want an entire movie looks like it was shot day for night. That's what this movie looks like. Was really aggravating. Alyssa, what on earth were the filmmakers thinking?
I don't know. And this movie, I have to admit, I just sort of zoned out during a lot of it. It is not particularly attention holding on any level. And that is, you know, sort of notable to say, given that, I mean, Will Smith is a wonderful actor, regardless of who he smacks in the face of the Oscars. And, you know, it's harrowing subject material, but it wasn't even like I was averting my eyes. It was just, it is a very sort of detached movie in some ways. And it is almost most interesting for thinking about as a movie. It's an opportunity to talk about sort of what kinds of stories one can and can't tell about slavery and what kind of enslaved people get to be characters in movies, right? And, you know, there is a sort of a requisite resourcefulness, nobility, humorlessness, you know, sort of matchless courage that, you know, is so de rigueur in a movie like this and is obviously at play here that it makes it very difficult to make Hollywood movies about slaves as people, right? And this is one of the many things that feels so striking about Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained is that, like, it's a movie about slavery that is funny, it's sexy, it's weird. You know, the, like, Django himself is allowed to be, like, a kind of magnetic sex object. And the characters who, you know, in, again, in Django Unchained, you know, the characters who are slaves and are collaborators with the white regime, right? You have this character played by Samuel L. Jackson who, you know, is allowed to kind of be a monster, right? And Emancipation has one of these sort of stock characters who's kind of riding, you know, a black character who's riding mutely along with the slave catchers. You know, he's sort of condemned as like, you're the worst kind shortly before he's killed. But again, he's like, he's not a person. And I think I have been complaining about that in a lot of movies lately. And I think it's legitimately extremely hard to make this, to make movies about slavery that have that tonal variety, that allow characters who are enslaved to be, like, bad or unpleasant or annoying or, you know, less than completely heroic because of the sort of political moment that we're in. And the thing is, you know, this movie is sort of set up to be the story of how this photograph is taken. And that would have been, in many ways, a much more interesting movie than the one we actually see. It would not have been sort of a good pulpy action movie, but, you know, it just kind of like comes in at the end, right? And there's no follow-up. There's no imagining the really interesting question, which is like, how does Peter feel about this photo, right? Like, does he know that it becomes the subject of sort of a nationwide sensation? Like, that is, you know, telling the story about if the photograph gets taken at like the halfway or even like the end of the first act break, and then you tell the story of the photograph, that provides much more space for the person who is the subject of that photograph to sort of step into the frame as an object and as a person, right? I mean, if you spend more time on Peter as a free person, there is more kind of political and narrative space for him to be a human being instead of just an archetype. And I, you know, I don't know how to get around this cinematic quandary, right? I mean, Quentin Tarantino can do this because by definition, he's an iconoclast and is sort of brave enough to do this sort of thing. But there is just not a lot of emotional or political or artistic space for black filmmakers, and I think, frankly, probably for most black actors, to play enslaved people who feel like people and who are not in the process of being reduced to the sort of their dignity and their right to freedom in a way made on persons on screen.
Yeah. Peter, what did you make of Emancipation?
I often like Antoine Fuqua as a director, and I'll also say I've interviewed him, and he's just like a great, friendly, like warm, smart, thoughtful dude. But this, unfortunately, is not a great film. I don't think it's quite awful, but it's really not very good. I think it's best when it deals in pulpy action moments, but also in sort of visual world building. Just some of the sequences of sort of what it's like at seeing a slave camp in its operations, right? These are big kind of epic, you know, shots and sequences. There's some really interesting, I think, drone photography in this movie where the camera sort of soars around an area and shows you not just what the space looks like, but how all the people are interacting with each other and with the space. And some stuff that I don't think I have ever quite seen before. But I totally agree that it was just a bizarre decision to film it or to color grade it after the fact in not quite black and white with occasional, you know, gray blues. Just a very weird effect that, yeah, like both of you, I found genuinely difficult to keep watching for the 2 hour plus running time. The only thing I could think of as a reason for why this might have been done is that the movie sometimes seems to want to, quote is wrong, but maybe allude to Schindler's List. And it felt like maybe that was the thinking behind this, was that this is in the same way that Schindler's List was, you know, all in black and white, that this should be, you know, sort of heavily sort of reduced. So you're just seeing the kind of, you're seeing the shadows of it, right? I don't know. I just don't think it worked at all.
I assumed it was because it's leading up to making a point about the power of black and white photography.
It could be that, or like designed to kind of mimic the daguerreotype, you know, color scheme. I frankly kept waiting for, like, for lack of a better word, a Wizard of Oz moment where, like, everything switches to full color and it's like he is free now and he's fighting with a union and it's things are better, or when he rescues his family, or just something. I was expecting a bit, and obviously that was wrong, because I could not imagine another reason for the film to be color graded this way.
I thought Alyssa's remarks were really on point here. I mean, it's on the one hand, it's with sensitive subject matter like this, it's hard to complain, oh, this movie wasn't fun to watch, right? Like that, you feel like that's not an appropriate complaint. At the same time, I think, you know, I read one critic call it misery porn, and I don't think that's entirely wrong, especially that first act before he escapes, you know, from the slave camp. And it just sort of seems to dwell on the misery and to make the misery stand in for the character and for the person in a way that I don't think actually reveals very much to us. It's also, once we get going and once, you know, sort of once the escape happens, it's very episodic, right? Like there's just sort of this thing happens and then the next thing happens. And it's almost chapterized, except that the chapters don't really lead to each other very much. It's just kind of, well, here's this incident and then that incident. And it doesn't develop characters and through lines that really pull you in. And I think it's just really odd that this was positioned as a Will Smith Oscar bait project, even totally forgetting all of the off-screen Will Smith Oscar bait, you know, Oscar drama with the slap and everything last year, because it totally robs Will Smith of what is his greatest strength, his ability to be warm and charming and kind of quirky and, you know, and even weird at times. It's a really one-note performance that just doesn't have many layers to it. And he's grim and dull, and the result is a movie that is grim and dull. I wish this were much better. I think there were some really interesting shots and sequences, color grading issues aside, but I just don't think it works.
Yeah, I mean, the movie is at its best during the chase and action sequences, the battle at the end. I think that's all really well done and really well shot. Fuke was great at this. I mean, I am the guy who goes to the Ramparts for Tears of the Sun once every 6 months or so. It reminds people to go watch it because it's great.
And even those big flyovers in the big battle sequence at the end, right? Like that stuff is just, I won't say it's the absolute best war sequences I've ever seen, but it's just staged so much better than many contemporary directors would stage similar sorts of sequences.
Yeah, well, and it effectively makes a point without hammering it home too hard, which is, you know, the Union Army is sending these guys into the meat grinder in a way that is more honorable and sees them more as men than the Confederacy did, but that, you know, it's on both sides of the line, they are being used as, you know, sort of almost industrial labor in this war.
As body fodder.
Yeah. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Emancipation? Peter?
Sadly, I have to give this a thumbs down.
Alyssa?
A regrettable thumbs down.
I have to give it a thumbs down. Again, I would probably give it a thumbs up if not for the exceptionally bad color grade. I think, Alyssa, you said to me it looks like a movie shot through an Instagram filter, which is very much how it feels. I just like I cannot fathom the choice here. It does not work for me. But, oh well, not my movie. All right, that's it for this week's show. Make sure to swing by atma.thebulwark.com for our bonus episode on Friday. Make sure to tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we will die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch, and I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.